Welcome back to Staying Power, a show all about resilience, what it is, what it isn't, what to do with what we have, how do we develop more of it, what do we do if we don't have as much of it as we thought or as we want. Whatever the situation may be for you, in the end, resilience is all about choice. And again, here to talk with me about all the different ways that we can develop resilience is my friend, my collaborator, my co-author, co-writer, co-content creator, co-host, and friend, not in that order, Tawny Santabria. Hi, Tawny. How are you?
I am well. Just got in from the garden.
Oh.
Been getting all my beds ready for us to get right into spring and get some things planted. So I've been spending a lot of time doing that.
It's been great. Yeah, awesome. I know how much you love doing your gardening, and it's great this time of year. Everything literally is coming back to life in the spring, and there's something about that. Which is an interesting segue into today's story that I wanted to put out for you and for our listeners to talk a little bit about. And it's always interesting to see where we go, you know, with these things. And the tie-in is this. Two things. Are you interested in poetry and are you interested in Japan, Tawny? Either one or both?
I'm always interested in learning. Mm-hmm. So... yes, let's go.
Okay.
Let's
awesome.
Go. Yes.
Awesome. The reason why I say that is because today's topic is about poetry, but not poetry itself. In Japan, spring is historically the era in which poems get written, right? And it has been this way for centuries. It's one of the biggest subjects in all of Japanese literature, and Japanese poetry is about spring, the new blossoms coming out of the winter, new life. And of course, Japanese poetry is famous the world over for its focus on nature, the outdoors, gardening, simple things, right? We talked last week about simple stories being very powerful. One of the things I love about Japanese literature, Japanese poetry, it's almost all about day in, day out, the things that we don't always notice, you know, the quiet things of nature, the quiet things in people, right? There's a real peace to it a lot of times. And so the reason why I came up with this, Tawny, is because I've been watching the number one, you know, watch show right now in the world is Shogun, right? The new series based on James Clavell's 1975 novel, which was, you know, one of the biggest bestsellers of all time. And they redid it into a 10-episode series. And it's not only is it great, it's being renowned around the world over for its historical accuracy and the amount of research that went into it, in everything from the dialogue to the costumes to the story. Even though it's a fictional story, it parallels the development, the rise of what we call modern Japan. And in it, poetry and all these things we're talking about have been so central to the story. It takes place in what is known, what historians call the Sengoku period, which ends just before 1600. It's about a period of 150 years before that, where in Japan, it was a period of just almost nearly constant civil war. It was a feudal system in Japan. You had the emperor at the top, but really the military leader, the shogun, most of us have heard that word. The shogun effectively ran the country, and then all the vassals, all the fiefs below him that they called daimyo in Japan, all sort of worked their way up in fealty. And every single daimyo had, and every single lord had a series of vassals that were samurai, professional warriors, for defense, but also for policing, for help, for maintaining the social order. And this went back, this tradition, this feudal system went all the way back to the earliest days of written Japanese history. So centuries upon centuries. By about 1600, though, as the rest of the world was discovering Japan and Japan was discovering the rest of the world, as was often the case in that period, cultures began to clash and had to reckon with people that were really different from them. So in the Sengoku period, because of all the wars that had been going on for 150 years, samurai were really at the forefront of society. And what I became really interested in watching this show, and I grew up among a lot of of Japanese in Hawaii when I was a kid. And so I was immersed in a lot of Japanese culture growing up. And so I've always been fascinated by it. But one of the things that is really fascinating in this show and then in the Sengoku period was the importance of poetry, not just in the court among the highest levels, but among samurai. And so samurai, when we get that visual, right, it's the swords, it's the katana, it's the battles, it's the, you know, there's a, again, a romanticism that we tend to get about it, at least, you know, in Western perspectives about it. But samurai in the Sengoku period, as well as previous to that and after, were expected to not only know how to defend themselves and to conduct themselves in war, but they were also expected to become masters of poetry, masters of the tea ceremony, masters of gardening, housekeeping, design of their homes. I mean, almost every single part of what we would call the Japanese aesthetic, samurai were expected to become very proficient and experts in. And one of the things that I found as I started deep diving off this show, wanting to read more about these things, was this practice that samurai had in the Sengoku period of having poetry contests. They would bring together all these different samurai, various levels. It could be at the highest levels of the court in a daimyo or even in the country. It could be in the smallest villages. And samurai would come together and they would sit in a big circle, right, in traditional Japanese way on the floor, right? And instead of each coming up with their own poem, they would actually write them together. The competition would be one would pick, would start a line. The next samurai would then build off that line, add their own. And in the old traditional style, we know haikus, right? Five syllables, seven syllables, five. That was a later invention. That was post-1600 Japanese. Before that, the form that was most common was a 5-5-7-5-7, five lines. Right. And so they would do these contests where there would be no pre-written poems at all. And they would build these poems this way. And then they would all judge them by the time they were done of which one was the most quality, which one of the samurai had actually contributed the most. And it was all focused on, at least in the Sengoku period, all the peaceful elements, all the things that were as far away from what these samurai were known for, right? Warfare, training, bloodshed, suffering, all these things. It was as far away from that as possible. It was about nature first, the spiritual second, perhaps love and family and honor, perhaps, but it was usually all those things taken together. And as is the case in Japanese poetry, as well as in Japanese art, it isn't just the words that are said. It's also the things that aren't said, right? In Japanese visual art, it's not just about what is portrayed on the page, but it's also the negative space around it is also seen as important. And so as I explored all this and read this, I found it fascinating that as people commented on these things, they were saying, and even around the show Shogun, there's a lot of people commenting saying, all these things don't seem to make sense. How can this warrior culture, on one hand, that is so ruthless when necessary, right, in defense of honor, in defense of the house, in defense of the country, and sometimes comes across as not really caring or valuing human life because it was all very tiered in the feudal system, how can they be that way on one hand and yet express these beautiful thoughts about nature and the world and the divine and the self at the same time? And I found that strange because to me, I'm not sure that that's necessarily all that difficult to understand. But what stood out to me in all of this was this notion of, you know, all these people thinking that samurai poetry contests are words that should never go together, you know? And so I started thinking about that. How do we associate the things that should go together? In this case, the starkness of a warrior on one hand and a poet on the other, even though Japan is not the only country that has those types of things. But then also, why do we find those things surprising, right? And so that's really what I wanted to put out in front of you. It's not a specific thing, but it is an interesting dynamic, I thought, for us to maybe explore today. What do you think? What comes up for you?
Why do you think that happens?
That other people are surprised by this?
Yes.
Mainly, I think, at least for Western eyes, there's something in that always seems very, very foreign, very different, very hard to understand of Japanese culture and Japanese ways of thinking, ways of doing. It's a culture that I think for many in Western situations is very foreign in that sense, and not just foreign in the sense of being in another country, but difficult to understand. I don't think that that's necessarily the case myself, but I think that's part of it. And because of that, I think there can be an assumption that because it's coming from a series of perspectives or cultural practices that seem so different from our own, that it's hard to see where there might be commonalities in our own context, right? Or in a context that's a little bit more familiar. That's the first thing that comes to mind for me.
Just that it's unfamiliar.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's sort of where it starts. I think there's probably more ingredients to that, but I think that's where it starts. So it's like, how does that work? Because they're already thinking that anyway. The language is so different, the practices, the food, the dress, the architecture is so different that there's just an automatic assumption that it's going to be hard to understand.
Okay. So it just is kind of like, you're feeling like it's just kind of part of the bucket.
I think so.
You know, I don't understand the culture, so I don't understand any of it.
Mm-hmm. I think that can be where it starts, perhaps.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So it starts. So does it go somewhere after it starts then? I'm trying to figure this out.
Well, I can't speak for everybody, of course. For me, it's not surprising, right? That's the thing. But in seeing how people have talked about it, both online and reviews of the story, in newspapers and things like that, it's this constant theme that comes back. What one newspaper called this dissonance between the violence on one hand of the samurai and their embrace of beautiful human things. And I keep coming back to, how is that different than, you know, I realize that the cultural context, the expression of it, what it looks like, is going to be culturally specific and unique. But I'm not sure that's a strange dichotomy necessarily for human beings. I just don't see that myself.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you make sense of it?
For me, I make sense of it as, when I look at it historically, I can think of a number of different examples of different societies and different places at different times that have people that are skilled in warfare who also embrace the arts. I mean, Winston Churchill painted, right? And wrote, you know, I mean, and was also, you know, a formidable politician and war leader, as most of us know. So to me, it doesn't stand out that much in that sense. To me, that's why I think it's the barrier is not necessarily being able to be familiar with, particularly this era, 400 years ago, 500 years ago in Japan, being able to see that human side of it. To me, it makes sense. And I know many people in my own life who serve professionally in the military who are also embrace these things, who are writers, who write poetry, mm-hmm. who, you know, those things. Those, to me, it's more about this mystery that is being attached to this by people who are kind of viewing this from the outside, when it doesn't seem like a mystery to me.
So your knowledge of history, your experiences with people who, you know, do both and mm-hmm. In their life, it tells you that this is more of a kind of a human experience. Like,
yeah.
Like there's a lot of cultures in history. So is it that we don't know history that this is showing up?
I think, well, certainly. I think that can be part of it. At the same time, there's so much history in so many different places. Not everybody's going to be able to learn or necessarily know all those things. I was a professional in it for a long time. So I've had an opportunity to explore it more than most people have. And so I'm aware of that as well. And so, you know, for me, it's not something I condemn or judge or say, you know, it shouldn't be that way. And a show like this provides opportunities for people to explore that. And I think that's valuable. That's why I like historical films. I like historical shows, even if they're not, quote unquote, getting every single thing right, which I think is overstated. I do like that it introduces people to the opportunity to explore that a little bit more. And I think the show in particular does a nice job in everything else of helping the viewer connect with the humanity in familiar ways with these characters, even though for the bulk of them, at least in where we live, it's a very different culture.
Yeah, for sure. So, okay. So there's just sort of like a limited experience. It sounds like that you're saying that people with their limited experience sort of just struggle to, you know, try to understand. And that brings up the, what we've talked about before for me is sort of like the knowing of something really is about experience, not book learning. Right. And we really sort of, you know, have these, you know, you talk about, you know, learning all about the different histories of different cultures and even like immersing yourself in some of those along your life, right? Like your, this makes complete sense to you that there would be both. And for myself, doing a lot with Eastern philosophy over the years for myself. Yeah. This makes the yin and the yang is the reality. But I don't know if Western philosophy learns that quickly.
Agreed.
So yes, if we're stuck with limited experiences of different ways of thinking or ways of living our life, you know, exposing ourselves to different sort of belief systems or different sort of practices, then we're only going to really know our own, or not even our own, but what we've only experienced in our life. And so we're going to be asking the question, well, how does that even work outside of what I know? Right. And so that's the part, like maybe there's exposure to history, maybe there's learning in books, but really that sometimes can even be like, well, still, I still don't get it.
Absolutely. And I think that's a really good point because I, you know, you have that experience in Eastern philosophy. I mentioned just a bit ago, I grew up as a young kid in Hawaii in a very distinctly Asian polyglot culture. You know, I was around that a lot. And so even for me, I'm not even sure to what degree, I mean, the book learning helps, right? The book learning is something that has value. But for me, the real connection point for the show and for the poetry, and I write haikus myself for a reason, right, is because I experienced that growing up. I was fascinated by that. I was comfortable in that growing up. And really, you know, when we learn about poetry, you can learn all the rhyme and the meter and how it's structured. We can learn all of that. But that's just the outside of it. That's like calling, like saying the content of a book is just the cover and the pages. Right. When really there's so much more to it. Like, you know, there's one poem, I'll read you one of these short, those 5-line poems that it's really kind of an experience to hear it. It goes like this: to those who wait only for flowers, show them a spring of grass amid the snow in a mountain village. That's an experiential thing to hear. I could study the words, I could study the structure, I could debate all those different things, but that's what I love about Japanese poetry. They don't go there. That's not what it's about. And what it's about isn't universal necessarily.
Well, yeah. I mean, each person is going to feel something very different from a group of words, from a description of an experience. Each person is going to experience something different, usually based off of their own experience or lack thereof, whether or not it's going to speak to them. Also, but for your experience and that resonates for you.
It does. Mm-hmm. You know, to me, it's the experience of hearing the words and what comes up in my body and in my feelings. You know, it's not an intellectual exercise. You know, it's not an intellectual point for me. And I become interested in the history of these things more and more as I get older, in just knowing a little bit more about the context of where it's coming from. But even that's becoming less important, particularly with something like art and poetry. You know, it's more about what I'm connecting to in the moment with that. And I'm sure if I read that same poem 5 years ago or the same poem 5 years from now, I might have different responses to it in some subtle ways or in some very real ways, very different mm-hmm. ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that's where learning to trust or learning to pay attention to our own bodies as mm-hmm. we're, you know, if we get this sort of surge or we get this sort of, oh yes. So we get this sort of like, like we get this sort of experience in our body that tells us that speaks to me. I can relate. Mm-hmm. Or no, not at all, mm-hmm. right? We don't need to necessarily be starting. We don't need to start thinking about all of this with judgment or with meaning like, oh no, that's right all the time and that's wrong. Mm-hmm. Once we start tuning into our body, we don't need to make that sort of like a mental exercise. But when we start to pay attention and we get those sort of feelings of yes and no, And then we just know, mm-hmm. and we can be, we don't have to rationalize or defend or critique or anything like that from there. We can just allow for that experience to be there and start knowing from there. So it's about ourselves. It's mm-hmm. not about what is right for another person.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. I like that a lot. I think, cause that's my experience. And even as a person who writes poetry and likes to write in the haiku style, I mean, I've been influenced by that my whole life. And every single one goes to nature in some way, shape, or form. I love that about this because nature itself, as we experience it, is so experiential, right? And we feel it in our bodies. We can intellectually write something about it. We can intellectually know what's happening with weather patterns and all those types of things. But what really connects us in those things is not that. It's not that specific knowledge. It's the experience of being outside. I think of you and your gardening and how much you love to do that you mentioned at the top of the show. There's that experiential piece in there just must be enriching in ways that words maybe wouldn't even capture.
That's our embodied experience.
Yeah.
Right. And so I thinking about your story and the samurais having to sort of become experts in the mundane, mm-hmm. experts in the doings of the day,
yeah.
you know, slowing down. Yeah. There's not a need to sit there and think about things yep. necessarily. There's mm-hmm. the bulk of the day is moving through, becoming more and more and more proficient around the action of things that do matter in the day-to-day. Mm-hmm. And also that just moves, there's a sense of, as we're slowing down that way, obviously they didn't necessarily need to slow down, but what they did experience was that yin-yang kind of thing where mm-hmm. yang being very action-oriented. And so it's like they're being the aggressive and the taking action and the really sort of that harder type of part of their, you know, job or role. And then the easing, the yin being more of the slower, the easing in, the noticing, the moving, you know, with intention in terms of like the pacing is much more careful or slow. Mm-hmm. I don't even want to say careful because there's a lot of practice that goes into being very proficient mm-hmm. in these wide range of actions that they take every day. Mm-hmm. And so all of that then becomes a very embodied experience, just being in a group of people where you're reading the line before and you're just writing what comes up. Mm-hmm. That's from a body space.
Yep.
So Western philosophy doesn't come from a body space, is the trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's very heavy duty thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is. And, you know, and from when I think about that from a Japanese context, but I think also in a human context, what better way, if you are a person who is highly trained to defend and protect and maintain order, I can see the value of connecting to these things in the body is a reinforcement of why you do what you do and why you care about what you care about and where you see your place. Now, that's defined different in lots of different cultures, lots of different time periods, and lots of different ways, and really in the end is defined person to person. But to me, I think that's why it makes sense. You have this from a body space connecting to beauty and mystery and that yin versus that yang. There's a reason why those things fit together. You know, to not have one is the other one is not in balance. And to me, that's what's I loved about growing up around in a culture, you know, exposed to a cultures like this for that reason. So anyway, it was just something that just captured me for whatever reason, you know, mm-hmm. And I think you nailed it right on the head, because in the end, it is what we're talking about with that is an embodied experience, and it comes from an embodied place. Mm-hmm. And yeah. To me, it just illustrates the value and the power of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Wow. I agree.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that was cool. I could read this kind of, I don't know why I prepped them, because there was no way I was going to be able to read them all, but I have like 15 of these things, but I just chose that one. So anyway, mm-hmm. Good stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and for those of you who are listening, thank you so much for listening to this episode of Staying Power. We would love to hear your stories of resilience, and if you think they're mundane, send them. We want to know them. There's beauty in the mundane, as we just talked about this week. And we also talked about last week. We'd love to hear those. You can reach out to us at stayingpowershow@gmail.com with those, or you can join our Patreon project. The link to that is in the show notes, and you can reach out to us there and share those stories. We'd love to hear them and talk about them on the air. And maybe I'll even share some of my own poetry over there, Tawny. What do you think of that? Maybe.
Sure.
Sure. Put it out there.
Yeah. See what Why not?
See what embodied experiences people have with that. I don't know. But nevertheless, we would love for you to engage with us in those places. And remember, you can get this as a podcast wherever you get your podcast. Thank you so much for subscribing, for renewing, or reviewing, I should say, and sharing it with your friends and your family and your social networks. We certainly do appreciate it. We will be back next week with another story to talk about. And until then, I am JDK Winnikin.
And I'm Tawny Santabria.
Enjoy the embodied experience of nature, everybody. See you next time.